This is the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. There are something like 5,000 colleges and universities in the United States, but only one college convenes only on leap years and has a set number of people, 535. That would, of course, be the Electoral College, which has nothing to do with higher education, but everything to do with electing American presidents. The Electoral College is what makes it possible for people to lose in the vote of the people and still win the White House. And it is the subject of a course at OLLI, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Southern Oregon University. Let's hear more about the course and how it's being taught in our age of physical disconnection. Susan Stitham teaches Electoral College Safeguard or Anachronism. She's the current chair of OLLI's Curriculum Committee and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Susan, welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
Sure. Good to have you. Let's talk generally about OLLI first with the pandemic going on. Have you been able to offer any OLLI classes in any form?
It's amazing what we've been able to do. Our people have really stepped up. As you know, all of our instructors are volunteers. We are offering over 100 courses online this fall, which is an extraordinary number of people taking on this brave new world none of us have actually lived in before.
Right. So a lot of people learning how to do Zoom and all that sort of thing, huh?
Exactly. And and so the courses cover all kinds of areas. I mean, it's almost as big as our ordinary in-person, but we're all, as I said, you say, learning how to live in this world. And it's we miss the connections, but we are really happy to have the classes. And I would just like to quickly say that anyone can teach at OLLI. You don't have to be a member. And so just go to the website, OLLI@SOU. We'd love to have new people offering classes for winter.
So this particular course you teach, Electoral College Safeguard or Anachronism, how long teaching it?
Oh, this is the first time. And it's going to be just a two-session course at the end of October. In May, I had the idea that possibly people might be interested in the Electoral College once we got closer to the election. And actually, there are two classes on Electoral College. There's a much longer one by Dave Runkel, who's about doing eight sessions and really going into the history and digging into the details.
Okay, so you're doing the Reader's Digest version, as it were?
Well, I don't like to think of it that way, but I suppose. At least you didn't say Cliff Notes. Thank you.
Right. Glad to do that. But you have apparently some history and teaching history?
Yes. I have taught a number of U.S. history classes, although I was an English teacher in high school mostly, and European history back long ago. But, I've been teaching a bunch of American history classes, and I have looked into some of the elections and got intrigued by all of this. So I'm looking forward to it.
You mentioned teaching it in two sessions and interest rising in election years. Do you find a fair amount of misunderstanding about how the Electoral College works?
Yes, I think that people actually are much more aware of it than we have been. I mean, for the entire 20th century, nobody paid any attention at all because it had no impact in terms of the results. The last time, the last time before 2000 that it impacted an election was in 1888, and most of us weren't around, although some of us feel like we were. But now we've had two elections, 2000 and 2016, in which it has made a significant difference, and I think people are much more aware and realizing that it's fundamentally a very undemocratic institution.
Well, it is fairly straightforward in most states, though. I mean, you win that state's popular vote, and you win the electors of that state in most of them. There's only two exceptions, right?
That's correct, which actually Nebraska and Maine, and I didn't realize until recently that those changes, that it was not winner-take-all in those two states, didn't happen until 1972 in Maine and 1992 in Nebraska. But the winner-take-all part, Jeff, is not part in the Constitution. That is something states adopted early on, and it has fundamentally changed the intention of the Electoral College.
In what sense in changed the intention?
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, the Electoral College never functioned as it was intended by the framers. They had an idea that a group of elder statesmen would get together, all had been elected by their state legislatures, and they would sit in a room together and deliberate who would be the best person to get their votes. And, of course, they knew a lot of those people back in 1787, but it never actually worked that way. The first election where it really impacted, because Washington, of course, both times was the only person in history to receive all of the electoral votes, when it was in 1796 with Jefferson and Adams, there were already the beginnings of political parties, and they were lobbying for slates of electors, and so it never became that deliberative process. It became an election, basically, the winner.
So it sounds like the idea at the beginning was not necessarily to have any form of popular vote reflected in what the electors were doing.
Absolutely not. The framers were not Democrats, small d, by any means. They were very much afraid of monarchy. They were very concerned about having a president that would be like a monarch. But they also were afraid of mob rule. And they were not Democrats with a small d, as I said. They established a republic. It was to be a democratic constitutional republic. The world's never seen anything exactly like that. But they wanted to, they did not have a trust in the people as a whole. They looked for the sort of, wise folks to make the decisions. So the thing that's changed for us is that, especially in the 1960s, with the Supreme Court and the one person, one vote was not a concept the framers would have had any awareness of or thought of. And once you get to the one person, one vote, you see how the Electoral College, because of the winner takes all approach that the states have adopted, absolutely is what Estes Kefauver actually said back in 1961. He was a sort of crusading, reforming senator from Tennessee. He denounced the Electoral College as a loaded pistol pointed at our system of government.
I noticed that. It's interesting that the timing is coming up, although I suppose, not totally coincidental because we have an election pending. But yeah, the Kefauver quote and some other things were in the lead editorial in the most recent edition of The New Yorker, I noticed just yesterday.
Nice. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking along their lines.
All right. Susan Statham, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, teaching a course at OLLI at Southern Oregon University, Electoral College Safeguard or Anachronism, two sessions at the end of October. But you can join our conversation here now on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760. I'm going to leave it at the phone number because the email box, like everything else internet-related in front of me at the moment, does not appear to be working. So 800-838-3760. One of the things that was pointed out of the New Yorker piece is that there have been lots of efforts to change the Electoral College over the years, but it seems like nothing ever got quite to the point of constitutional amendment, it seems.
No, I read somewhere there have been like 1,200 different efforts in Congress. Mm-hmm. But actually, what I did not know is in 1969, and maybe that's in the New Yorker article as well, that the House actually passed a constitutional amendment, and President Nixon supported it. He called it a thoroughly acceptable reform, but it was filibustered by some segregationist senators who killed it, and it never has gotten past that since.
I noticed now that the one person, one vote that you brought up has been proven really interesting because one of the points I've been noticing is the difference because of the fact that you've got the Electoral College is composed of the number of electors is the same as the number of representatives and senators. Therefore, small states get a minimum of three. Where they only have one member of the House of Representatives, that sort of thing. So in Wyoming, each elector represents far fewer people than the 700,000-something that each elector represents in the state of California.
Exactly, and that is true. And it really means that, one of the interesting myths about the Electoral College is that somehow people have been persuaded that it means that that the presidential candidates would campaign around the country in all states. But in reality, that does not work at all, and they're focusing about six to eight states that they're called the swing states that could be go either way, because of the winner take all. And I think one of the points that people are beginning to understand is that if in fact we had a national popular vote, then the Republican vote in Oregon and California and Washington State would be sought after by Republicans, just like the Democratic vote would be in Alaska, which was my previous home.
Well, that's exactly the point I was going to ask about, because the argument is that the candidates would just campaign in big cities. That may be true, but they'd campaign in big cities in states where they don't campaign now. There's no point for a Democrat to go to Utah or Oklahoma, just like there's little point for a Republican to come to California or Oregon based on recent election results.
That's exactly true. And I believe that this would make the election much more national in that sense. I think fundamentally, Jeff, the issue is for people who support its maintenance now, is how you look at states and whether you feel that a state is an entity that is discrete, distinct in personality, culture, values, and needs to be represented in a way that may have been more true 200 years ago or even 100 years ago than it is in our time of the social media, the national media markets. That's an interesting question.
You mean the idea that each state is so different, or was perhaps back then, that they needed to be heard from through the Electoral College?
Yes. there was a protection, a part of the checks and balances kind of thing, like mm-hmm. the Senate. You know, that, and if you recall at the Constitutional Convention, which neither of us attended, was the issue really was between large and small states. That was one of the huge problems, was how to reconcile Rhode Island and Virginia and Pennsylvania, right? The fear that the small states had. And that's what the Senate was established to allay, and then the House would be, you know, popular vote. And so that was meant to be part of the checks and balances situation. But because of the three-fifths compromise, which was, you know, one of the shameful parts of the Constitution, some states, the slave states, ended up getting a disproportionate amount of representation until the Civil War.
Right, because the slaves were counted as three-fifths of a person when the original plan was to count them for what they were, which is not citizens at all, therefore not part of the count, but there we go. So, but interesting, though, because, I mean, aside from the horrible aspects of counting one person as three-fifths of a person and the horrible aspects of slavery itself, we have made some amendments thus far. The whole insulation from direct popular vote changed in the Senate more than a century ago. Senators used to be chosen by state legislators, and so that changed to direct popular vote, but we just haven't gone down that track with the presidency.
Well, I really think it's partly because, as I said, for the entire 20th century, it never made an impact, you know, and people just sort of thought they were voting for the president, and not realizing, of course, many of them, they're voting for a slate of electors put up by a political party. And now it's been brought to people's attention. And, you know, we've had two presidents in the last, you know, 60 or 20 years elected with less than the popular vote, dramatically so, in 16.
Absolutely, yeah, by Donald Trump losing by 2.8 million votes to Hillary Clinton in the popular vote. Susan Stitham is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, teaching a course at OLLI at Southern Oregon University called Electoral College Safeguard or Anachronism. A couple of fences I've noticed in the Electoral College that Democrats without Southern accents don't seem to win the Deep South ever, and Republicans don't win California or Massachusetts much.
Well, that's changed, though, and I think that's an important point, that states have changed their complexion, so to speak. California used to be a reliable Republican state until, you know, maybe the 70s.
After Reagan,
Yeah, and other states have changed, you know, where they've gone. We talk about the red and the blue now and the purple and the, you know, things that are changing. So one of the arguments in support of the Electoral College is that it doesn't benefit any particular party because states change their complexion. And that, of course, when we're caught up in it, it feels that way to us because we only are looking at immediate past.
Right. And it's interesting to think about the moves to change and their regard based on the circumstances of the moment. Richard Nixon didn't see any particular problem with getting rid of the Electoral College because he had won the popular vote and was and figured to win it again in 1972, which he did, despite the whole Watergate thing. But now we got a different situation where it seems like the people who might have once said, yeah, sure, it's okay, let's do away with the Electoral College. Nixon's party is the one that has now won the Electoral College without the popular vote twice in 16 years.
Yes, and I think that's right, because then we tend to want to hang on to the things which benefit us and find some rationale for it, right? Without taking it. Another interesting point that I just got a new book to read before the next month goes by, called Why We Need the Electoral College. And one of the arguments that she makes is it keeps us a stable two-party system rather than the parliamentary multi-parties that we all of our fellow, you know, Western democracies have. And that's true, because we all know that it's almost impossible for a third-party candidate to win in the Electoral College.
Well, it's interesting to look at it that way, because I know that I talked to lots of people who are thinking, you know, can we stop having just salt and pepper or A and B or chocolate and vanilla? But the two-party system is driving some people straight up a wall.
Well, there's actually a couple things there. One would be one step in the right direction might be to do a proportional, like Maine and Nebraska, a proportional allocation of electoral votes would at least go down the road partly, right, to reflect people, that the fact that no state is monochromatic, right? There are people of other parties. And the other is ranked choice voting, which is not what this topic is today, but I know that Maine has gone to ranked choice voting, and it's being considered in a number of other states, including Alaska, which lets people vote for you know, third parties. and not waste their vote, so to speak.
Right. And then, of course, there's the whole popular vote compact, which we don't have time to talk about today because we're almost out of time. So, Susan, when are the Ollie sessions on Electoral College Safeguard or Anachronism?
Well, now you would ask me that. They're the last two Wednesdays in October. And by the way, yes, enrollment is still open. Mm-hmm. Because we have unlimited classes in about half of them. That would be the 21st and the 28th of October.
Okay. Susan Statham, thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. I enjoyed it. Take care.
Take care.
Be safe.